This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studios, here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, sometimes I have so much fun talking to an author that I usually have to wait a year until they come out with their next book, but in this case, I am so happy that I am welcoming back to Joy on Paper, I think one of my favorite guests, because he is just so wonderful. Lang Martin Jr. is a Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame member, and I tell you, you know, when we think about Nashville songwriters, we sometimes think they're going to be good old boys coming down from the mountains carrying a guitar. But in this case, Lang has broken the mold, and his life story is fascinating. And his book, Permission to Fly, a memoir of love, crushing loss, and triumph, it was released in June, and it is an amazing book. And I'm so happy to welcome you back to the program, Lang.
Patsy, that is such a treat. Thank you so much for giving me a second shot.
Well, you know, I just need a day. I need a day where I can just relax and just enjoy the entire process of going back. I went back over our interview, and I could just hear how much fun I was having talking to you. And also, it's very funny. Your book, there are many sad things that happened in your life, or horrific things, actually. But it is also a very funny book. And you have so much humor in it and so much love. And I have been, over this past month or so, I've had opportunity to talk to people about it, and some people who themselves have suffered tragedies. And when I tell them about a book that somebody who's poured his heart into this book, I tell people, but he's still full of love. He hasn't given up. He has the joy of living, and he has he's been married for, 54 years now?
Oh, you have a good memory, yes. 54
to a beautiful woman. And I think it's just so wonderful. Your story is a love story, and it's a story of optimism and true grit. So it's just wonderful to have you back.
Well, thank you so much. It was such a treat that day that we talked, and you said, gee, I want you to come back. And then I was so deliriously happy yesterday when I found out you actually want me back.
Well, I do, because I have a book that I think really will touch people's heart. I don't just promote it on the day that it comes out, which, you know, generally is what happens. When a book comes out, people, you know, review it and they say, okay, read that book. And then everybody forgets about it, a few months later. But I go back, and when I have a book that I feel that people will really, they will relate to this book. There are so many things in this book that are fascinating, and of course your life has been fascinating. So let's go back a little for the people who might have missed that one, the first interview, to talk about your career as a songwriter, because it really is an unexpected, you are not what most people would think of as a Nashville songwriter. You didn't come down from the mountains carrying a guitar and with your barefoot and your shoes slung over your shoulder. You came from a very privileged life. You are the grandson of a senator and...
A congressman.
Which is quite an amazing story. And you come from what state?
From Connecticut.
Connecticut. Nobody thinks of a country western R&B songwriting genius coming from Connecticut.
Well, that's for sure. In fact, it was very hard to get any country stations in Connecticut. the only country songs we heard for the most part were those that had crossed over, you know, from, you know, you'd be much, much younger than me, but there were songs like Abilene and sometimes an Elvis record, you know, All Shook Up or things like that that made it on the country charts and on the pop charts. But those are the ones that we heard. And so when I heard country songs so often, I just gravitated to them, and I really don't know why. But I also gravitated to, you know, very simple rock and roll songs of all kinds, Chuck Berry and things like that. But they were the songs. It turned out, Patsy, that they are very simple. So when I got my first guitar, which was after we'd been married for a few months, I guess our first Christmas, my wife gave me a guitar, and I found that quickly, within a few days, I could learn all the chords that were in these songs that I loved. And of course, country songs are also quite simple. And, you know, it's these guys that did, as you say, come from the hills and the valleys and stuff of America that made Nashville. They made the basis of this music that we all loved. And I, you know, thought they were incredibly sophisticated. I mean, some of the emotions, you know, Hank Williams, Oh, Lonesome Me or something like that. I mean, that's everybody in the entire world. It's not just from any state or given place. But they're very simple, and almost everyone can play them. And so I just gravitated to them because they spoke to me. I mean, all those Everly Brothers records that we, you know, Bye Bye Love and all that stuff, they're fairly simple, and they can be played by someone who's not particularly sophisticated on their instrument, so they can be enjoyed by families and people just sitting around. And anyway, I fairly gravitate toward very simple stuff, and so they just totally computed to me because they're so rhythmic and emotional.
Well, you certainly have written some amazing songs. Of course, people know that you wrote the last song, that new song that Elvis Presley sang and recorded, which of course was a big hit. Unfortunately, you weren't there when he sang it, and it's I think sometimes you must like just dream about if you would have been sitting there while he recorded it.
Yeah, well, you know, I do have a friend who played on that very last recording session, and he described how Elvis took the microphone off of its stand and into his hand and kind of walked around with it in the room that day. And it's just really something to be speaking with someone who was actually in the room. And then later on, Linda and I went into that room. It's the jungle room at Graceland. And I thought, and it's a tiny room. I don't know if you've ever been there, Patsy, but the jungle room, which is very famous, is very small. And so you think, God, all these musicians were in here, and Elvis is walking around with the microphone, and it all happened right within these very few square feet. They've left the room at Graceland looking exactly as it was then. You know, something really interesting that relates to what you were saying about the people, you know, coming from fairly simple circumstances. Almost none of the songwriters I know in Nashville can read music or write music. And to me, that's just so fascinating because they just make up the melodies. And then if the song gets recorded and you need a lead sheet made, you know, to sell the sheet music, then you hire somebody for $35 or $50 and they write down the notes. So I've always thought it was very interesting that even though someone plays the guitar beautifully or the piano beautifully, they, chances are, at least in my growing up, most of the people that I knew could not read music. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, I think that's why the music comes from their heart. And that's why,
yes, exactly,
that period of time is really the golden era, because the music, they didn't need the paper. They didn't need to write it down. It came from their heart and their soul. And that's why these songs live on, and songs written sometimes, you know, nowadays by people who might, you know, have all sorts of degrees in musicology, the song doesn't come from their heart, and they don't last.
Well, it may come from their heart. It's just a whole different thing if you are writing it down as your. I don't even know. Like today, I'm sure that, you know, they some write them down, some don't. But most of the songs that do endure have, and you know, some songs that you know certainly that I grew up on don't even really make any sense, you know, and you don't care because they're just so rhythmic and exciting. You know, like I think of a song like, I don't know if you remember 99 Tears. Do you remember that song?
Oh, yeah.
It's just got such musical magic to it. And, you know, someone say, what's that about? I say, I don't know. I guess it's about 99 Tears. I couldn't sing you one word from it, but every time I hear it, it's just magic. So what you're saying about these things coming from people's heart is so true, because if it just pours out of you and it's colloquial in whatever way that could be colloquial in actual language or just colloquial in that its music speaks to you from such a primal place, it sticks with you. And so I think, you know, kind of like when you see someone playing tennis and they're, quote, in the zone, you know, they're just playing, like they're not even thinking about it. They're just hitting the ball back, and they're just so, and perfection is lined up in their skills that day. It's very much that way with songwriting. And I think we all know the feeling of sometimes we're very articulate and sometimes we're totally inarticulate. So often when we're very articulate in speaking with someone or explaining our feelings or something, it's when we're really not thinking that much. It's just pouring out of us because our emotions have taken over, and they're writing the words from our brain to our mouth. And that's the ideal when you're songwriting, when you kind of get sort of that feeling when you first wake up in the morning and you get a really good idea, or just when you go to sleep at night and you think, oh, God, this is such a great idea, I'll never forget it, and then in the morning you can't remember it. That's the spot when you're writing songs. It's just pouring out of you, and you're not analyzing or overthinking. It's just your raw, what you said, emotion, and that's the ideal. It doesn't often happen perfectly, but you can't make it happen. Sometimes it just taps you on the shoulder and says, okay, go for it.
Well, so tell us about Way Down, which is, of course, the song that Elvis recorded. Tell us about how did it come to you, and then how did it get to Elvis?
Well, that really is pretty interesting, because I went every day into this 4x4 office that Ray Stevens, who was my publisher, had given me to write my songs, and I loved it. It was just this tiny spot where the sound seemed perfect to me, and I had a small shelf in front of me that held a tape recorder, and I went in there every day, Patsy, every single day. I didn't get into, do I want to go in there? Do I have a good idea? I just plain went in there, and I picked up my guitar. I had notebooks filled with song titles all day, every day. Anytime I got a title, I would write it down on a receipt or, a napkin, put it in my back pocket, and every few days I would transcribe it into these notebooks. So one day, I was just in my little cubicle there, and I had this Way Down was this title, and I thought, well, what is, and I just started this song and started writing it, and it just felt good and felt rhythmic, and it was just one of the songs that I wrote just constantly in this stream of songs. And that particular day was a rainy day. I went in and played it for Ray Stevens, and he said, boy, I just love that thing. Let's call the band today. It's rainy, nothing going on. Let's make a demo of it. So we went in, and Ray had his band that he travels with playing, and I sang it, and Ray sang the bass part. I'll send you the demo of it. If you give me your email or tell me how to do it, I'll send you the demo, and you'll hear Ray's bass part, which is so fabulous, that J.D. Sumner did on the Elvis record. But I had this demo, and it was so good, and I took it to everyone, Ronnie Millsap and all the people that were great of that day. No one even held it overnight, not even a little bit of a twinkle. And then one day I was at someone's office taking them a song, waiting to my turn to play, and this very, very famous music publisher named Bob Beckham sat down next to me, and everyone knew that he had a direct line to Elvis's producer, who was a man named Felton Jarvis. Well, Felton Jarvis was just almost like a ghost. Almost no one had ever seen him. He was just a legend. And Bob Beckham said, Lang, do you have a song for Elvis? Because if you do, Felton's coming by my office today around 3 o'clock. Bring me the song. So I went into our tape room, and I listened to all the songs that I thought might be contenders for this opportunity, and I narrowed it down to 3. I was going out the door to get a disc cut, because you had to have a disc. Elvis only listened on a disc. He wouldn't listen to tapes or cassettes or anything like that. So to get a disc cut cost, you know, I forget, $20 or $40 or something. But I was going out the door. I could put one song on each side of this disc. And I asked Ray's secretary which of the 3 she would take. And one of them was Way Down. She said, I'd play him Way Down. And it was the one I'd kind of decided not to put on the disc. So I altered my choices and put Way Down on there and took it over to Bob Beckham's office. And about a week later, Patsy, I get a call that he thinks Elvis is going to go bonkers for this song. Well, months pass. I hear nothing. And then one day on the street, I hear that Elvis is again looking for songs. So I get another disc cut, take the song back to Bob Beckham's office, and about an hour later, I get a call that says, it says Bob Beckham's secretary, and she says, Lang, I think Elvis has already recorded this song. And I said, well, that's impossible. I would know if he'd record. She said, I'll call you back. Calls me back in about 90 seconds and says, yeah, he recorded this, October 30th in the Jungle Room at Graceland. And I thought, this is the most absolutely amazing sentence I've ever heard in my entire life. I get in my tragic little car, which had 11 colors of primer on it, no headliner, race home, tell my wife that Elvis recorded my song. And then they put it out in June, the year before he, you know, the 2 months before he died. And literally playing tennis in Rhode Island, where I am right now, 1977, the little girl comes out of the tennis court and tells me there's a phone call and that Elvis has died. And 2 days before that, Patsy, I had found out that in Billboard the following week, the song was going to be number one. So one day I find out it's gone to number one, and 2 days later I found out that he's dead, and there is no more opportunity ever on the planet to get a song recorded by Elvis. So that's just how bonkers things are in the world.
Oh, it's so tragic. His loss was so tragic. Are you going to sing this song for us?
I don't have my guitar with me.
No?
Oh, God, were you? No. You know, it's so weird. I'm in Rhode Island. I don't have my guitar with me because we're on vacation. But I'll sing a little bit of it. The song starts, babe, you're getting closer. The lights are going dim. Sound of your breathing has made the mood I'm in. All of my resistance lying on the floor. Taking me to places that I've never been before. Oh, but I can feel it, feel it, feel it, feel it, feel it, feel it, feel it. Way down where it feels so good. Way down where I hoped it would. Way down where I never could. Way down. Down, way, way on down, way on down. Like
I love that song. I love it.
Oh, you're great. Thank you.
And you still have a good voice. You know, that's for sure. It's very.
Thank you. Well, you know, it was just so amazing to think that Elvis had learned the song listening to me sing it. I mean, Patsy, I have like the beginning of my book. You may remember, I'm sitting in my mom's car, seventh grade girlfriend, in the back seat, and my mom's driving us to the movies, and Heartbreak Hotel comes on the radio, and I said, Mom, please turn it up. Who is that? And it was the first time I'd ever heard Elvis. So the time that the idea that he ever recorded a song is just so impossible, I just don't even know where to start.
Well, you know, it is such an amazing story. And, you know, sometimes in life things are meant to be. And sometimes even the tragic things are meant to be in a way that they give us strength and we learn from them. So your book, you know, I tell people that Permission to Fly is such a wonderful book in so many ways. One, because it tells a story of how your mother is the one who gave you permission to fly. She was not one of these mothers who, you know, said, don't do it. So I want you to tell us a little bit about her, because I think, you know, I love when mothers influence their children in the right way, and she certainly influenced you. You know, the fact that you're such a great writer, some of her talent rubbed off on you.
Well, yeah, you know, she was a magazine writer. Well, she started out, Patsy, writing stories for a magazine called Modern Screen, which was in the 40s. It was a movie magazine. So she would go and interview, you know, actors and actresses, and then she would write about the movies. She reviewed the movies and did these interviews. And then later on, when she had, you know, the five kids that were in our family, she would still find time to write stories, which she called come-to-realize stories. And they were stories about women who had struggles and so on, and through the struggles came to realize some important truth about their lives. But she was in every magazine you can name, which the Saturday Evening Post, Ladies Home Journal, Red Book, Cosmopolitan, everything you can name, she was in those magazines. And so when I was beginning to write songs, all of my lyrics I would run by my mom, and I would go into, you know, her office and say, you know, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? I mean, and that had good pluses and minuses, but like one of the minuses was an example of this, my obsession. I walked into her office one day. She's lying on the floor. And I said, Mom, what are you doing? She said, I can't get up. And I said, well, why not? And she says, I don't know. You know, I can't move. And so I kneeled down next to her and I held up this piece of paper and I said, well, what do you think of this first verse? And, you know, it's just like, Lang, give me a break. I can't move. You know, I'm dying here on the floor. So those are the obsessions that we all have, where we're just so focused on what we're doing and we really aren't always thinking of others, which is not a great place to be. But it sort of happens sometimes when we get obsessed with something. But she did give me, she encouraged venturing out, Patsy. She believed that I was going to learn outside the house lots of things I could not possibly learn inside the house. So she encouraged me to have these adventures, and she convinced me that when I ran into trouble, I could rescue myself. So she never rescued me. And what was ironic there is that when I, you know, did run into trouble, she never knew about it because the whole point was to handle it myself. It was one of the sort of humorous aspects of it. And later on, when she was 93, I think we were 80 to 93 when she died at 95, we'd have beers at night and stuff. I'd tell her some of the stuff that had been, we went skydiving and all this kind of stuff that we did growing up. Oh my God, I'm so glad I didn't know that. I said, well, of course, that's why you didn't want to know any of it.
Well, I think they should make a movie out of this book. And that scene of your mother on the floor and you showing her your lyrics will be a memorable scene.
Well, listen, if you know anybody that makes movies, please give them the book. I think it would be a great movie because there are so many, all of these people, you know, like Benny Goodman when I was his pool boy, and I don't know if you remember the guy out west in Wyoming there. These characters, some of whom, like the Wyoming guy, I only knew that guy for about 20 minutes, Patsy, but his way, he was well into his 80s, his way of handling me and of talking about, you know, very quickly his situation. He was a lawyer, and he got people off. He said he could get people off if the crime was on film. He was just a very confident guy. He had gone to Harvard. He was a Rhodes Scholar, but here he was in this beat-up little office in the middle of Wyoming, and he could get these people off, but they couldn't pay him often. So he had all of this property, these ranches, and he would send the people up to work off their debt to him on the ranches. And the job he wanted me to do was to drive this little school bus up there and pick up these guys every couple of days and bring them back and then take them back and bring them back to have R&R for a few days. But I said, well, what do these guys do? Kill people? He said, oh, hell yeah, they kill people. They rob banks. They give me the list of all things they do. And I said, well, I don't think I'm the guy for that. He said, why not? He said, you think they're going to hurt you? And I said, yeah, I do, you know? And so, but this guy being so incredibly educated and also this sort of rough-hewn character was an example of things that, you know, you learn. You think, okay, yeah, this guy's a Rhodes Scholar. He's been to Harvard. But he's also a nitty-gritty guy with common sense who has absolutely no problem saying, you know, that, oh, I tried to borrow $400 from him. That was the funny thing. Before I left, I asked him if he'd loan me $400 to buy a motorcycle to complete my trip because I was hitchhiking around the country. And he said, well, I won't go into what he said. It's in the book. But you know, he had no problem just saying, no, that I'm not falling for that. But so the net of it was in 20 minutes with this guy, he's just an unforgettable person. So,
well,
also, just a sidebar on that, Patsy, it was very interesting. His sister, Jeanette Rankin was her name, was the first congresswoman from America, the first woman to be a congressman. And so I think that was fascinating.
Well, this is what I'm saying. I think this would make a fantastic film. Now, I am supposed to take a commercial break. But I'm not going to take a commercial break. I don't care. I just want to tell.
I hope you don't lose money.
No, I just want to tell people that one of the people who support the program is Bill Larson of Larson & Larson. He's an intellectual property lawyer, and he's my intellectual property lawyer. He's really smart, and people can get a hold of him at larsonandlarson.com. And one of my other sponsors is Glenn Erickson, and he is an author himself, and he supports Toastmasters and many, many different organizations that support writers. So both of them, I want to thank them in advance. I'm not telling them, but I'm not playing their commercials today because I'm having too much fun. And I think they will appreciate that when I have somebody as wonderful as you, as Lang Martin Jr., I'm not doing any commercials. I'm not doing any breaks. You have the whole...
Oh, well, you are.
You have the whole hour. I told you last time I said I'm going to give you an hour, and I'm giving you the entire hour because you're just so...
Well, you are too sweet because nothing could be more fun than talking to you. Your questions are just so fabulous. They're so leading, and that makes such a difference.
Well, thank you. And as I said, you know, I mentioned when we talked before that I used to write screenplays. I wrote a screenplay for Apollo... Astronaut Walter Cunningham's book, The All-American Boys, and I've adapted some other books for the screen. And, of course, when I'm reading your book, I kept thinking, oh, this would be so good. This scene would be so good. As you said, the Wyoming one and so many others with – and there are so many famous people who sort of float in and out of your life that alone would be fascinating. But then we have the beautiful, beautiful love story that sort of is a basis for how you started the book and why you started it. And so why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we are married, as you said, now for 54 years. And midway through that, my wife Linda was crippled in a car accident. She had been a fabulous athlete. And, you know, she had run marathons and, you know, cleared our garden of, 8-foot brambles and done. She's as capable a person as could be. The three times we moved in our lives, Linda and I personally together moved all our appliances, all our furniture. We moved everything. And we're just a team. We're buddies. And she is also totally brilliant, apart from being, beautiful and everything. But her common sense is just so perfect. And so, Patsy, when she had this accident, the moment I found out about it, which was on the telephone, I spoke with the doctor, and my first question to the doctor was, can she think? And he said, yes, she can think. Her brain is fine. And he had told me that she'd ever been able to be able to walk again. But I knew that wasn't the crux of our relationship. Our relationship is our friendship and our ability to talk with each other. And an absolute sidebar to this is her incredible judgment, because everything that's important that I've ever had to do in my life as an adult, I talk over with her, because her common sense is perfect and her courage is perfect. And, you know, in the book, I talk about, you know, losing everything, including our house, when I made a mistake and had a restaurant, which I had opened in hopes I could have time to write songs while the restaurant operated itself. That shows how stupid I was. But when it did go under and, you know, we lost everything and I felt, you know, 150% responsible for that, I asked Linda if she, you know, if she wanted me to go back into advertising, which I really, really hadn't enjoyed, or go for it in Nashville, which is really where my heart was. And she said, oh, no choice, Nashville. Well, we already had two little kids and we had no money. And we went to Nashville, and I became, after having had a good job on Madison Avenue on 17th floor with an office and a window and all that stuff, the next thing you know, I am loading trucks in the middle of the night with other Teamsters and pulling rolls of carpet off 110-degree trucks and stuff that are, and I'm just thinking, but while I'm doing this, Patsy, I'm thinking, you know, how realistic is it that I could have a hit record? Because if I have a hit record and Linda, I have everything, and I know nobody ever gets everything. And then when one of my songs, which is called Rub It In, did become a hit, I thought, well, this is just incredible. I have everything. I have Linda, and I have a job that I love, and we have enough money to live and take our kids to Disney World and all the things you want to do. Of course, I had to keep having hits or I'd run out of money. But for that moment, I thought, this is just the impossible dream, and I still feel that way because our whole life we've been able to be together, and I could go to our kids' teachers' conferences and baseball games and all the things that my dad hadn't really been able to do. I could do. They were the things I wanted to do. So the fact that, excuse me, Linda would, you know, bet on me, so to speak, and roll the dice and go to Nashville and live in a very simple apartment and go through all the heartache of, you know, having no money and all the uncertainty and everything. And so when she had this accident, you know, and she turned out we could still talk and have exactly the same relationship we'd always had, I just thought, well, if all it takes to go through this is effort, I've got the effort and I've got the energy and we'll just do whatever it takes. And we did. And but she has the hard part, because not being able to walk or feel below your chest is just more debilitating than can be possibly described, because it's not only that you can't walk, you can't, you know, reach your glasses if they fall off the table when you're trying to watch television, or you have bowel movement in cars when you're driving with your friends, and it's just stuff that you can't even imagine. But she never mentions it. It's never a topic. She's always smiling. It's just an uncanny sort of person. So I tried to write a story about 10 years ago, what our life had been like since her accident. And just writing that story, Patsy, which is only 800 words long, took 2 years, because figuring out how to describe what our life had been like took really telling all of these nitty-gritty things, some of which are very unpleasant. But if I hadn't told those things, no one would really know what the hell I was talking about. So I described, you know, what it's like to try to find a handicapped bathroom when you're walking on the street in the city that you don't know, and who will let you use the bathroom. Lots of people won't, and lots of bathrooms are downstairs, and lots of bathrooms aren't wide enough to get in with the wheelchair or some stopping point like that. So I told, okay, Starbucks will let anybody use the bathroom. Southwest Airlines gives you the first seat on the plane, and you can roll to it in your wheelchair. Some theaters don't make you sit 4 feet from the screen where you can't really see. You get to sit back like everybody else. So I tried to describe these things that would give people more of an appreciation for what it was like. Anyway, this story was published in the New York Times on Sunday, and it just drew this enormous response from all over the world. And that response felt so good because I felt as though I was making contact with families and what I call love-based people. And it just was so thrilling to me. So I just plain kept writing. And my mom died before the book was finished, and I didn't know it was going to be a book, but it turned into one. And before it was finished, she died, so I never got to, you know, she never got to read it. But before she did die, we had coffee one morning, and, you know, she said, how do you think you and Linda survived after her accident? How do you think you made it and held it together? And I just said, you know, it's because, you know, we wanted each other so badly that we would do anything. But the reason that I was able to hold up my end of the bargain was because you had let me loose in the first place to learn how to recover from difficult situations and failures and impossible situations. And it seemed normal to me because she had said at one point when I was about 15 and I sort of thought I knew everything and had seen it all, you know, she said, "Lang, be careful, because whatever got you the last time will not be what gets you the next time." And that one thing has been so true, Patsy, because you have these incredible shocks, and instead of saying, "Oh, how did this happen to me? Why did this happen to me?" you just know that that's the story of life. And she prepared me for that so that instead of thinking, "Oh, isn't this awful that this has happened?" Your mind clicks to the next thing, which is, okay, what do we do now? And that's a whole different thing from the tendency to wallow in the, "I can't believe I've just minded my own business and this happened to me," because that happens to all of us constantly. So anyway, I was able to many, 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 many times thank her for just being the most giving, loving person, because there's a big difference between saying, "Lang, that's nothing you can't take care of yourself," or saying, "I'm going to go talk to that teacher," or "I can't believe that policeman arrested you. I'm going to go down to the police station." People do that. That's not a good thing. It's much better if your kid just says he has to go to traffic court or he has to work it out with the teacher or whatever it is. And that's what she just, that was no choice. She just said, you know, "The teacher hates your guts, fine, but you're stuck with her and he's stuck with you, so work it out." Yeah. And those were the skills and that have just come in handy practically every day. And I, as I say, was able to say that without her, you know, doing that for me, I probably would have been buried a long time ago.
Well, you're lucky you had two wonderful, wonderful women in your life. And, you know, I think that Linda, it's so, so lucky to have someone with such a good heart that you have. And tell me, did she inspire any of your songs?
Well, in a way, all of them, Patsy, because my songs were influenced by all the songs that I loved growing up, which most of were boy-girl songs. You know, love, the excitement of, you know, sexual attraction and the emotions that you feel when you're just crazy about somebody. And so songs like All Shook Up, you know, Whole Lot of Shakin', all this kind of stuff, they were things that just infuse my bloodstream. So most of the songs that laid the financial base for our life were sort of these boy-girl, sort of sexy, what I think of as fun songs, like Rub It In, Rub It In.
Sing a little, you know, Rub It In. Go ahead and sing a little Rub It In.
Rub It In, it says, "Lay beside me on the sand, put some lotion on your hand. Come on, make me feel nice. Kiss me once or twice. Say you love me again. Rub it in, rub it in." You know, like that.
I love that song.
You know, they're songs that, again, and they're all based on the fact that I was just crazy about girls. And, of course, when I met Linda, I was just so totally head over heels, bonkers over, like, in 13 seconds. It's never ended. It's just accelerated. And so all of those emotions went into my songs. I mean, the song that bought us the house we lived in for 42 years was a song that it wasn't a massive hit, but it got to number 10. It was called Wiggle Wiggle. And it's just something like, I told you not to do that on the dance floor. You said you wouldn't do it in public anymore. Monday through Friday, you kept it all in. Now it's Saturday night, and you're at it again. Wiggle, wiggle. Honey, cut that out. Wiggle, wiggle. That's what I'm talking about. You know, it's all boy-girl stuff, you know? So, you know, but, you know, I look back at them and said, well, that was me. That was a little youthful whatever feeling, and it turns out that they gave us our life, you know? But anyway,
and their songs, they are really wonderful songs that will last, because I think people are going to be singing these, you know, 100 years from now too, because they're songs that put a smile on your face. And I will say, nowadays there are not that many songs that put a smile on your face. I'm not much into rap, but I've listened to it, and they never make me smile. You know, but your songs, so many of your songs, just, you find yourself smiling, you find yourself wanting to dance, wanting to wiggle a little bit, you know, have fun.
Well, that's so nice, Patsy. You couldn't say anything that I love more. Because one of the things that I learned about songs that was so odd is that it's how does the song make you feel? That's the message. And sometimes, in analyzing songs, I learned that there were songs, I'll give you an example of a big, huge record from when I was growing up, called Oh Lonesome Me. And it went, everybody's going out and having fun, look at me, I'm staying home and having none. And that was the happiest song. I loved it. I turned it up when I was driving, and somebody said, Link, listen to what he's saying. He's saying, oh, lonesome me. I'm tragic. I'm alone. And I said, yeah, I know, but that's not the message I'm getting. The message that I'm getting is, wow, I'm alive. Look at this.
Exactly. You know, so it's funny when you say listening in the car. This is something that I do all the time. From when I was a teenager, I open the windows and I play this kind of music very loudly. I mean, it's really loud. And I'm singing and my hair is flying and I have the windows open. And when my boys were little, they would say, Mommy, why are you doing that? And, you know, I'm driving down the street and they're saying, you know, they're sort of embarrassed. People are looking at you. And I say, but you feel the music when you hear this music and it just gets to you. You need to feel free. You need that.
Oh, God, you hit it. That's so true. I mean, I do think that it's this just what you said, this freedom. You roll down the window and you say, I may be a mom. I may have two kids. I may be 35 years old. But I'm irresponsible and a lot of fun, you know?
Exactly. I did drive them crazy when I was young, because here in Florida, they have a lot of these signs, drive friendly. And yeah. since I had the window open anyway, I would wave to people. And my boys would, oh, no, Mom, don't. You know how kids are. They, you know, they don't want anybody to notice anything. But I'd drive friendly. Why not? Because I'm playing the music loudly.
Well, also, it does make you feel kind of bound to others. You're connected to other people. The music, it's definitely, I mean, when you go to a ball game and they play, you know, Start Me Up or something, and everybody loves it, it's a unifying element. I definitely think that music, it doesn't get into politics. It just gets into the human feeling, so that's magic.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I really hope, and as a matter of fact, as I said, I used to write screenplays, and I hope that maybe somebody will listen to this interview and get the idea that this book, Permission to Fly, a memoir of love, crushing loss, and triumph, would be a fantastic film. There are so many, well, first of all, I love, here you have a film full of music. I mean, but real music. Music that, as you said, if you go into a ball game, you feel the music. In this, if somebody makes this movie into a movie, people in the audience will be like amazed. Where is this music is touching us? We're sitting in the theater and we want to jump up and we want to wiggle, wiggle. Or we want to, you know. I mean, it's just, there's so much joy in those songs. And then, as I said, there are so many scenes in the book from the really tragic things, but also because there's so much, so many funny things, and you just relate. You've related to so many people and touched so many hearts. I really hope that somebody will make this into a film. Because you, I mean, let's just talk for a moment just to sort of remind everyone of some of the people that you knew and that you worked with. You mentioned Benny Goodman, and you knew him when you were very young. That alone is a wonderful scene. Tell us about knowing Benny Goodman, because my parents loved to dance also, and one of the they had old Benny Goodman tapes, and they'd listen to them, and they loved to dance. So tell us about Benny Goodman.
Well, I met Benny Goodman because the very rural part of Connecticut where we were living during the Second World War, after the war, became kind of fancy because people discovered that it was only an hour's drive from New York City. So wealthy New York people began buying summer houses and weekend houses all around us. And these people wanted someone else to mow their lawn, wash their cars, you know, clean their swimming pools and so on. And so I started knocking on doors because I mowed all the lawns in our neighborhood and did other odd jobs. And when these new people came, I just wanted to recruit them too. Well, one of the doors I knocked on was that of Benny Goodman. And I became Benny Goodman's lawn boy, his pool boy, his later on drove him to concerts and stuff. And he had no daughters and no boys around. So sometimes he would call me for, you know, really special things. And one night he called up and he said, "Hey, Lang, I just got a movie of my life story in the mail. You want to come over and watch it with me?" And so, you know, I went over there and he went into his pool house and he made popcorn and we watched his life story. And, you know, at the end of it, he said, "What'd you think of that?" And I said, "That was unbelievable. Is that all true?" And he said, "Yeah, most of it's true, you know." And we just kind of got to be pals. And he also set an example for me, Patsy. All of the men I knew went off early in the morning and came home fairly late at night. So they really weren't day-to-day part of the family. But Benny Goodman would be lying by the pool, 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday, asleep in his terry cloth robe. And I looked at that and I said, "God damn it, you know, that's a kind, I want to have that kind of freedom where I can bust my tail and do something worthwhile and fall asleep in the afternoon if I want to. If I want to work all night and produce whatever it is, I just admire that kind of freedom." And one day when I was mowing the lawn, you know, first of all, his wife would put out a Coke for me every time when I was mowing the lawn. She'd put a Coke on the picnic table and she would point to the bottle and she would point to me while I was mowing. And I would turn off my mower and I'd go and I'd have this Coke. And one day I was having my Coke on the picnic table and she and Mr. Goodman came out and they sat with me and they just said, "You know, what do you want to be when you grow? What do you want to do in life?" And I said, "I want to go everywhere. I want to do everything." And Mr. Goodman said, "You are going to do it. You're going to have that life that you want." And I just never forgot it. I thought, God, this greatest guy is telling me I can do it and be it or whatever. But the huge irony was I never, ever, ever thought of earning a nickel in the music business, Patsy. I'm working for Benny Goodman. I'm listening to records day and night, Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and all these people. Never crosses my mind that, oh, Jesus, maybe I can be in the music business. Maybe I could write songs, earn a living doing something like what he does. Never crossed my mind until I was long not his pool boy anymore. I was about 20, I think, before I wrote my first song. So I've always thought how ironic it was that here I am working with this incredible musical icon and never dreaming that I could also one day maybe be in the music business.
And that you were blessed with a wife who said, "Let's leave New York City," where most women want to be in New York City, and head out to Nashville, which was a small town in those days. It wasn't like it is today.
Right. It was a small town. It was very, very, very different. You know, lots of things, lots of the movies that were in the theaters were also on TV at the same time. And, you know, the Times, New York Times and stuff that we'd gotten used to, you know, the Sunday Times didn't come until Tuesday or Wednesday, and you usually had to make a special reservation to get one. I mean, it was just so many changes. And, you know, living in an apartment where, you know, lots of the people were either foreign or what. I mean, it was just foreign, like, you know, immigrants doing jobs with, you know, very different from what. I mean,
different from New York.
Linda had been designing fabrics that were on the, you know, floor of the Hilton and the What else? The Hilton and some other huge hotel. Oh, the Plaza, on the floor of the Plaza, and the main, Palm Court. And her fabrics were in every store, Bloomingdale's, everything. So we went from this, feeling very much part of the world. Well, or just where sort of everything was available and, but we were doing exactly what we wanted to do. And the people in Nashville accepted us. They put their arms around us. We felt a hug from people from the very first day. It was just absolutely amazing. We felt welcomed even though we were, below zero economically, below zero in any form of status. The people were sweet, and that made such a difference. It enabled us to feel at home almost immediately, which is just a remarkable thing. Nashville's that way. It's incredibly
Well, one
inclusive.
Of the things, when I think of you, I think of sweet, because you are so sweet, and it is such a joy to talk to you. And I told you I'd give you the entire hour, and I did. And it's gone too fast. So now you have to promise to come back and next time have your guitar.
Okay.
And we're going to talk more about it. And we'll talk more about some of the scenes that should be in the movie that they're going to make of this book. Because they have to do it. This would be just the Benny Goodman scene. And I love that scene of your mother laying on the floor. I mean, I'm sorry about that. At the time, she didn't feel so good about it. But I love that scene. And I think it would be a wonderful thing for her to know that, yes, this turned out to be a good scene, right?
Well, Patsy, and you, I can only imagine what a fantastic mom. Anybody with your spirit has got to be every child's dream to have a mom like that, because it just rubs off on you. You see that spirit and that love of life, and as a child, you pick it up. I mean, I got it from my mom, but I bet my life that your kids got it from you, and that's the greatest thing you could pass on to somebody.
Well, and I homeschooled them because I just wanted to keep them around, so I decided to homeschool them.
Oh.
Anyway.
Well, you're a treasure, and I thank you so much for giving me a chance to be on your show.
And as I said, you're going to come back with the guitar, and we'll talk more about everything and about some of the other famous people you knew, Reba McEntire and Muhammad Ali and, Bishop Sheen. And there are so many, many things, all scenes for the movie, right?
Oh, I hope so.
Okay.
Thank you, Patsy.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Take care of yourself.
Okay. Bye-bye, Lang. Bye.
Bye, hon.
Wow. He is fantastic. I love him. Remember, one of the things I tell everyone is one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, to hear them spoken in audible book, or if you're lucky, and I hope Lang will be, to see them up on the big screen when they make a major motion picture of his life, because he is a fantastic human being, a wonderful, wonderful man, so kind and so intelligent. And the book is really great. And I hope that you will all, just get out there. And if you need inspiration, get his book. It's called Permission to Fly. And it's by Lang Martin Jr. And it's available wherever books are sold and on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And say something nice to somebody today. I'll say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. And also thanks to Glenn Erickson and to Bill Larson. And thank you, everybody. And have a wonderful, wonderful weekend.